This hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Check out riverbendcmhc.org for more information. New Hampshire Primary interviews on the show presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 1-9, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College, as we're joined by our regular panel of Wayne Lesperance and Dean Spotis, as opposed to our irregular panel. This is our regular one. We're joined by Cory Booker, Democratic candidate for president, in just a little bit here in the Barley House, and we're certainly excited about that. We'll start with Dean, your expectations, you know, talking to Cory here for the first time, what are you looking to hear?
Well, just trying to get a sense. Obviously, we want to introduce him to our listeners. He has been pretty active in the state so far, has fully embraced the retail politics ethos here in New Hampshire, which is always great to see. But there's still a pretty big pack of candidates lumped together. It may be that way for some time, maybe until we get them on the debate stage. But anyway, looking for, you know, some sense of how he differentiates himself in terms of policy, in terms of strategy, in terms of experience, leadership, et cetera, from this big group of 22 candidates at this point.
Wayne?
There's a whole lot I'd like to talk to him about, but let's just talk about a couple of the bigger ones. We've not heard nearly enough from the candidates about the role of Commander-in-Chief. I want him to put on the hat and tell us what's priority number one if he's president as Commander-in-Chief. He's been in the news lately as well. He took a different point of view from Elizabeth Warren on Facebook and social media deregulation, or regulation, I should say. I'd like to know a little bit more about that. And, of course, ever-present in a Democratic primary is identity politics. So let's get into that a little bit as well.
Yeah, I'm interested in all those things. And also, Cory Booker is seeking to be an individual that is going to unite our nation, an individual that is going to use positivity in order to break down what divides us. But we are a cynical nation at this point to a large degree. And is the positivity too much? Or is it something where you run a campaign and you're happy with your campaign if it is something that is positive and something that you believe in? So we'll talk with Cory Booker about all those things when we return. This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Check out riverbendcmhc.org for more information. New Hampshire Primary interviews on the show presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 1-9, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program Pints of Politics, presented by New England College. We have the Lifferman's Brewed right here in New Hampshire for the show today. We're excited to welcome in New Jersey Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker here to the program. Cory, how are you?
I'm really, really good. I thought this Pints of Politics was going to be doing an interview while we're giving blood. No,
and you're in the wrong spot. That Pints of Politics is actually two blocks over.
I thought it was giving a pint of blood. It would be great. We'd be doing something for the Red Cross.
Yeah, that's good. We got to use that.
Now, if we combined this pint with giving a pint, I think that would be disastrous, though. But I think
true too.
We should perhaps set up a station down the road moving forward. Well, Cory, thanks so much for joining us. And to start off, just kind of give an upshot of what has driven you to engage in this process, which is a grueling process. It's a rewarding process, but one where your whole self has to be into it. What has driven you to want to engage in this?
I'm so glad that you asked the question that way. Often it gets asked, what makes you distinct in a crowded field where 2020 stands for not the year of the election, but how many people are actually running 2020? Look, I'm driven every single day. Life is about purpose, not position. From the time I was coming out of law school, moved into an inner city neighborhood to organize against very powerful slumlords, I've just always believed that if you organize people, bring people together, you can do things that people say can't be done. We did it when we took on the slumlord in the projects I lived in for almost a decade. We did it in Newark, New Jersey, in a city that unfortunately had a reputation for crime, corruption, and decay, to now make it at the center for economic growth in the state of New Jersey. Did it in Washington when people told me you couldn't pass criminal justice reform, the comprehensive bill that passed under this president bipartisan way, was a bill that I led on the Democratic side in the Senate with Dick Durbin. So I just feel very strongly that we're a nation right now that is seeing too much tribalism, which is zero-sum, us versus them, fear-based politics, and that ideal of the beloved community, which is when we've done the best things as Americans, from going to the moon to beating the Nazis to beating Jim Crow. We did these things when we came together across racial, religious, geographic lines and affirmed the common bonds. And now at a time when there's growing injustice in our country, where there's challenges, where we're, Americans all across the country are feeling common pain, I'm running for president because I want to return us to that sense of common purpose and get things done that make a difference in the lives of Americans.
You're one of the best public speakers I've seen. And seeing you early on, before you even announced running for president back in December in a house party setting here in Concord, and a couple other times as well. And your passion is one that comes through in a very real sense while you are speaking. I'm curious as to what point you decided that you had a gift, because you mentioned your background and where you came from. At what point did you realize that you wanted to be an individual that could potentially run for president? Was it something early on? Did it happen when you were the mayor of Newark? At what point did that start to permeate?
God, I mean, my early ambitions were everything but politics. I wanted to be a great nonprofit leader. I moved to Newark, New Jersey, as I said, to be a tenant organizer, to start a nonprofit. My heroes were not in politics. But I thought you were going in the beginning to ask that question. It's just, my biggest fear growing up as a kid was speaking in front of crowds.
Mm-hmm. How'd you overcome it?
Public school teachers.
Really?
Who recognized that I literally would shake if I had an assignment that I had to read in front of a class. Mm-hmm. And these incredible, you know, teachers who said, okay, we're putting you in the school play.
That's remarkable, because I had the exact same fear. And here we both are, you know,
doing jobs,
doing this, which is pretty remarkable. Anyway.
Yeah. And so I all that I am is from the public schools in New Jersey. And that's one of the reasons why it's just a big issue for me on this campaign trail. But the deciding to get into politics was really my community. It was a tenant president. After we started getting a lot of ground, they decided that they were going to try to take on the machine, take on City Hall, and beat a city council person and get one of their reformers in. And I was sitting in a community meeting, and the tenant president, a woman named Miss Virginia Jones, says, "You're going to run for city council." And I'm like, "No, I'm not. I'm your lawyer. I thought I had a really good role with the team." And she's like, "Boy, why are you here? Are you here to be a lawyer? Are you here to help people? If you're going to help people, we're telling you what we need. We need you to be the candidate." And it was one of those moments that I learned right away that, indeed, life is about purpose, not position. And my purpose was to make a difference. I need to listen to people who I was connected with and make a change. And so that got me into politics. And we ran. Back then, the joke in Newark was that the only way incumbent city council people left office was death or conviction. and we ended up beating a sitting incumbent who was decades older than me, been in office for a long time, not by taking a votes away from him. He got the same amount of votes he usually got. But we brought out an entirely new electorate by organizing grassroots efforts. It's one of the reasons why I love New Hampshire, is because this is a retail state. It's all about organizing, all about connecting, inspiring people in living rooms, connecting with people in small town halls. In many ways, this is how I came up in politics. I feel in many ways like this is my 98 race all over again.
Dean?
Sure. Senator, ask you a little bit about domestic policy. Then my guess is Wayne will probably follow up with some foreign policy questions for you as well. You know, we've talked to a lot of candidates in this cycle, and pretty much everyone supports the idea of Medicare for all. But what I've started to realize is that it's become a phrase with almost no meaning at this point. Every time we talk to someone, they have a different idea of what that means. So
yes.
I guess my question for you is, do you support the idea? And if so, what would that look like? And then the second question that I wanted to ask was, what about private insurance and the private insurance market?
I'm so grateful for you asked that, because I'm frustrated that we're seeing just campaign slogans, trying to reduce policy down to slogans and not talking about practically what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And as a former mayor, it's almost offensive. I mean, we've got to be a country where voters who want to hear ideas get what they really are bargained for, not just slogans. So let's just start on the common value that I think all Americans share, that in this nation, healthcare should be a right. We should not be the wealthiest nation on the planet Earth and have healthcare be out of reach because people can't afford it. I think the best way to get there is having a system of Medicare for all. But I'm also going to tell you right now, whoever is elected to president, they're not going to get there right away.
Sure.
It's going to be a long path to get there. And as president of the United States, that's the end I'm going to work towards, that common value. But the first things I'm going to do as president, let me give you four real quick. One is stop the sabotage of the Affordable Care Act, which we've now gone down in the number of people covered. We're not funding everything from just helping people sign up online to get involved in it to stopping a lot of the payments that are undermining the ability for people to be able to afford it. The premiums are going up and more. Number two is we're going to create a Medicare for all who want an option or some type of more viable public option by expanding Medicare. We were one vote shy of doing that to make Medicare eligibility 55. Now, that what that's going to do is it's going to bring more people into Medicare and actually make people in private insurance.
So would you make it optional or let's say you move it down to 55 or even 50? You'd be required to move on to that, or you would still have the option of private insurance?
I think the thing we can get done is making it a viable public option.
So if I don't want to option. So
yes.
So if
I'm with my employer and I don't want to leave, but a lot of people will, and it'll make the private pools that a lot of people like their insurance, but it'll make them healthier because there'll be less older people in them. Number three, we've got to make sure that we're driving down the cost of prescription drugs, and that is something that to me, the average American is spending about $1,200 a year. Imagine that if you're making 30 grand a year. I had somebody here when I was in the North Country show me their bills for Medicare, and they were telling me they were making about $24,000 a year. And so the way we do that is use Medicare's buying power to negotiate down, and we do exactly what other countries do, which is say, if you're pricing drugs in our country higher than others, then we are going to show a penalty. The penalty in America for us will be taking away people's patents and allowing people to undercut it. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you and I both know in this absolutely expensive system, so many people are taking money and driving up costs that have nothing to do with patient care. Mm-hmm. We spend three times the cost on just administrative costs than our closest peer nation. And we've got to start stopping this gross waste within our system and get more money to patient care. Getting our system, frankly, away from where it's designed right now to deal with illness and disease on the back end of problems. We need to do that. But if we start having a system that also focuses on preventative care, early intervention, early detection, we're going to start to lower costs as well.
Well, and I'll turn over to Wayne, but I think getting to what you said, I think that the distinction between a public option as something separate from the idea of Medicare for all, that has kind of been lost, I think, in the last 6 months of the debate around health care. And you seem to be making that distinction again.
I want to make the distinction, especially because we need to talk about what we can accomplish given the American people in general and the opposition party. We've got to show Americans, and this is going to be my goal every single day when it comes to healthcare, is that we can lower your costs and expand access. And that will hopefully eventually will get us to Medicare for all, but we're going to gain a lot of trust if in my first year in office, I dramatically lower your prescription drug costs and I dramatically lower your premiums, copay costs as well.
What are the dangers of ideological purity, of saying we should have Medicare for all because healthcare is a right, and help the current system be damned, private insurance companies be damned? That's some of the Bernie Sanders and other opponents are saying.
Well, come to my block. I'm the only person in this race that lives in an inner city, low income, below the poverty line, black and brown community, where my neighbors, we don't have time to wait for to have purity hold hostage progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was mayor and even was a senator, when I come home, people want to just know, how have you made my life better? And sometimes God, if you could just make it a little better. So my criminal justice reform bill, my opportunity zones bills, they're making my community things better. And I had to work with Republicans across the aisle and negotiate. So I just understand what we want to have our ideals out there and fight for them and eventually get there. I got to a lot of my ideals when I was mayor of the city of Newark. But right now there are Americans who are struggling who, God, if you could just cut my prescription drug costs in half or three quarters, that would relieve a lot of pressure. We'll get there eventually where everybody like other systems gets them as part of their health coverage. But show me some progress. And by the way, the more progress you make, the more momentum you'll get and the more people will believe in you and trust in you to take the next step.
That is Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker joining us here for Pints and Politics at the Barley House presented by New England College. This is Wayne Lesperance.
Thanks, Chris. Senator, it seems to me we've spent precious little time talking about foreign policy this cycle so far. I would argue that with an aircraft carrier battle group headed towards Iran, with the redeployment of B-52 strategic bombers and other military movements in that direction, the world remains a very dangerous place, and at least some would argue that these movements are contributing to that danger. You've been elected. Let's talk about your top priorities in terms of engaging the world as the next American president.
So first of all, I am talking everywhere I'll go about foreign foreign policy, whether it's in deals with climate change, which is a foreign policy issue because we only produce 14% of the problem. We're over punching over our rate. We're only 5% of the global population. But we need to see it as a foreign policy issue that's not just rejoining the Paris Accords, which is just the beginning. We need to use our foreign aid and our diplomacy to work with other countries to get there. I also talk about in the context of just the grievous waste when people ask me how I'm going to pay for things. Well, we spend way too much money on things like foreign interventions like we did in Yemen, where you have us literally refueling the planes that are then dropping American bombs for the Saudis on Yemen, on Yemen that then produces more of the problem. In other words, the instability, the cholera, the famine there is creating a more of a climate where extremism often can thrive. And so we've got to start understanding that we live in a country where injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, where even our failures to deal with Ebola right now in Africa, infectious diseases can threaten us on our shores given the way that we have an interconnected world coming to travel. So all of these issues are interrelated to the health and well-being of our country. And so the biggest driving theme must be our values. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is engaging in moral vandalism. And your example is one of the best ones, is what's happening with Iran right now. We actually have a more dangerous Iranian state than we did at the beginning under this president because he has no strategy and he's doing foreign policy by toxic tweet. Look at this guy literally saying, oh, we're going to pull troops out of Syria right away, and his generals go crazy. What kind of strategy is that? You're going to create more danger. You're going to give Iran a highway through Syria to load up Hezbollah and endanger the state of Israel. We had a verifiable deal with Iran to keep them from getting a nuclear weapon. You now pull out. Now Iranians are saying they're going to race to a nuclear weapon. And now your response to that is to ratchet up tensions even more when you could have stayed in the deal and kept our eyes and inspectors on the ground making sure the Iranians weren't doing that. And by the way, if they violated that deal, you could have then gone to the aircraft carriers. So you're almost creating, Mr. Bolton, the very problem that it seems like you wanted from the beginning.
Right.
So I'm going to lead with our values. I'm going to make sure that we have strategies. And the last thing I want to say is show you the absurdity of where we live right now is talk about foreign policy. We've got China who is forcing our companies to give up their intellectual property, is stealing intellectual property, is subsidizing industries to undercut ours, state subsidies to undercut our businesses. And instead of joining with our allies in all of us teaming up on China, the European Union, the Japanese, third largest economy on the planet Earth, and us, you know what we do with our foreign policy? We use a foreign policy waiver to put tariffs on our allies like Canada. Well, you all knew up here, know in New Hampshire, I'm sure you know that the threat to the New Hampshireites is Grand Staters, is those Canadians. I mean, come on. Instead of teaming up with Canada and other allies to put pressure on China and win trade wars, he's tweeting about his bluster and not getting us to where we need to go. The same thing with the North Koreas, telling us you have nothing, tweeting out, we have nothing to worry about. Meanwhile, the problem is getting worse in North Korea, not better. I will be a president that leads with our values and our ideals and makes sure that the strongest nation on the planet Earth multiplies its strength by doubling down with our allies against totalitarian and dictatorial countries.
So including the use of force where appropriate. It sounds like you're saying that if we needed to maintain troops in Syria, you'd be for that.
Oh, let me tell you right now. I would not be violating the Constitution in places like Syria like Donald Trump did. Mm-hmm. When you bomb the Assad regime, you know it literally says that war powers lie with Congress. Did he come to Congress for that permission? Yeah. No. And so I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to honor the separation of powers and not be committing forces in the way that he's doing. But when it comes to Syria right now, I'm not going to pull out in a reckless way that's going to create more of an obligation for troops in the future than we have right now. I'm going to bring our troops home, but I'm going to do it in the time and the fashion that ensures that we as a country are affirming our values and don't create problems in the future for us greater than what we're seeing now.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House at 1-9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program Pints of Politics presented by New England College. We'll take a brief break and come back with more after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council and also by New Futures.
This hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Check out riverbendcmhc.org for more information. Hampshire Primary interviews on the show presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council and also by New Futures.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 1-9, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. We're honored to be joined by Cory Booker, Democratic presidential candidate and senator from the great state of New Jersey. Peter Evers is here from Riverbend Community Mental Health, and we've talked a lot over the last number of years about the mental health crisis in our nation and the economic instability that at times coincides with issues of mental health and mental illness. And I was interested in your plan in regards to gun control and requiring licensing. But you know, to me, I still believe that whether it's the opioid crisis or in regards to situations with mass casualty events, mental health is at the root of these problems. So gun control can be part of it, but real common sense in regards to addressing mental illness is important in my view as well. So what is your plan to deal with this, and how significant do you feel mental health is in regards to health epidemics facing our country?
Right, and I hope people will take some time to look at the larger plan, because it's about 14 different points. Some of them directly go at the epidemic of suicides. Remember, 100 people are dying in our country every day on average of gun violence, and about 2-to-1 suicides to homicides. And these mental health issues that we have in our country, the way we've stigmatized it, the way we've tried to deal with mental health through incarceration, which is a far more expensive way to deal with the problem, and it doesn't elevate human health and human dignity. It actually creates more expense and more problems when it comes to people's mental well-beings. And so we have to have a mental health really a strategy in this country, because we're now at a point in our nation where all of us know or ourselves are struggling with mental health issues. Often we're afraid to even come forward and talk about them when this is a medical issue. And so my plan for public safety is everything from making sure that we have appropriate red flag laws that have due process as a part of them. It makes sure that instead of treating mental illness with jail and prison, we use health care and treatment. It means making sure that we're creating avenues for people to get the kind of health and help and support they need, so they're not moving to gun violence more often. And we shouldn't stigmatize people with mental health actually have lower rates of violence unless it's against themselves. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't stigmatize that mass shootings are always at the source of that. In fact,
that's very true.
What we're seeing in this country right now, and something this president refuses to even admit is a problem, is the majority of the terrorist attacks in the United States of America since 9/11 have been done by right-wing extremist groups, homegrown, and the majority of those have been white supremacist groups. Mm-hmm. And so we have to have a strategy for dealing with the problems as they are and not doing things that compound problems and make it more expensive for us in the long run.
In terms of economic instability, one of the reasons that both Barack Obama and Donald Trump were elected President of the United States is individuals in urban settings and suburban settings feel that the nation has left them behind. That's the same programs being used over and over again in urban settings, as you well know, in Newark, have still left individuals in poverty. And there have been promises made about jobs returning to suburban communities, the mill towns across this state. And that hasn't happened. And stoking of fear and division have led to a lot of success for political candidates, but not a lot of solutions for individuals. How do you, as President of the United States, create an environment where both of those groups can rise?
So I think that is you literally are hitting the core, in my opinion, of what one of the problems is in our country, is that we have those tribalistic politics. We have politicians standing up on the national stage and telling them, your problem is other Americans. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what it is. You hate other Americans, the Democrats or the Republicans, or worse, the people in inner cities or people on the coast or people in the internal. Come on, enough of this. The greatest leaders in our country's history have always unified Americans and let them understand that their common cause and common purpose is what should overcome our common pain. And as a guy who's tried to actually solve problems and fix things, I've shown that, in fact, I was just up in your North Country talking to people. Hey, I'm from a community that was shedding population that people looked down upon or overlooked. And here are some strategies that we turned a city around that's now growing in population for the first time. And by the way, I didn't just do them as mayor. I passed legislation. In fact, I walked into a brewery up there, to a local brewery. And as I was walking in, the wife of the owner said, stopped me and said, your legislation, Opportunity Zone legislation, was legislation I wrote with Tim Scott across the aisle. It said places that are low income in this country, and every governor can designate a quarter of their lowest income.
Franklin's areas. Another one here in New Hampshire.
Exactly. Yep. Another opportunity zone that they have better tax treatment to incentivize investment. And she was saying, you're going to help us create millions of dollars of new development in that North Country community and dozens and dozens and dozens of jobs. So my strategies at work to turn our city around, there's actually some application for rural areas, factory towns as well. So two other things I think are really important to mention here is that we have to start investing in rural infrastructure and have to give people the bones upon which to build upon. I want to have a rural Marshall Plan that involves everything from rural broadband to water quality and the kind of things that are going to help a lot of New Hampshire towns really have the basis, the foundation upon which to build upon. And the next thing I want to say is that for people that live in those communities, we need to start making sure we're targeting them and their issues. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have something called the RISE credit. Why are we giving all this tax breaks to the wealthiest of wealthy Americans under this kind of perverse idea that somehow it's just going to trickle down, it's going to bank shot, let's give you, somehow it's going to benefit the average worker? Well, that hasn't happened. Corporate profits are at an 85-year high, and we've seen decades of wages barely budging. My RISE credit says a couple things. One is we're going to give every American worker who's making under about $90,000 a year a chance to get an extended earned income tax credit back. That means a family, a couple who make combined $90,000, you can get up to $8,000 back more than they're getting now. That's a really substantive thing for a family, especially if you're making $35,000, $40,000. But let's go further than that. We should redefine what work is in our country. That person who's staying home to take care of a spouse who's got Alzheimer's, that should count as work. You should, you're going to qualify for our tax credit as well. And so starting to understand the changing nature of our society, what work is, making benefits more portable, making sure we're targeting tax cuts, making sure we're not overlooking communities that have strength, that have worth, that need investment, making sure we're investing in rural hospitals and rural education. These are the kind of things that are actually going to help towns fight back against a lot of trends that have been in they've seen eroding their culture and build up again. I'm the guy in this race that comes from a community that, like a lot of the places in the North Country, and we fought back in Newark and turned our city around. We can do that for every community, factory towns, farm towns, rural communities, suburbs, and cities.
That is Cory Booker, Democratic presidential candidate. Join us here for Pints of Politics at the Barley House, presented by New England College. This is Dean Spildes.
Yes. Hi, Senator. I don't want to give you whiplash, but I want to go back to something that you said with Wayne on foreign policy to make sure I understood correctly. So let's take President Trump's, you talked about his missile strike on Syria when they launched the cruise missiles.
Yes.
If I understood you correctly, you said for an action like that, you would go to Congress for advance approval?
Me and others on both sides of the aisle, Jeff Flake on the Republican side, I'm pretty sure Tim Kaine was one of those people speaking up. The Constitution says that if you are the war powers exist with the Article I branch of government, that's the Congress. And so the president was saying, I'm using the authorization of use of military force from 2001-2002, which allows us to fight terrorism. That is, first of all, it was written too broad. Every single president, Obama, Bush, as well as Donald Trump, has used that to do foreign interventions, use of military powers all over the place. But in that case, in Syria, we weren't going after terrorists. We were actually going after the Assad regime. So was that a legal use of military force?
I guess my concern is, you know, the founders talked a lot about the need for the commander-in-chief to act with secrecy and dispatch. We saw during the Iraq war, President Bush was very upset with leaks coming out of Congress, and he threatened to cut off briefings at one point. I guess my question is, would you go in and ask for, you know, okay, give me authority for some period of time, and then I'll act as I see appropriate?
No.
Or you'd literally say, hey, I want to fire missiles on these folks, give me your approval. I'm not 100% sure, Wayne, you can correct me, but something like that, you might be the first president in 80 years to get approval for that.
Look, let's understand this. If there's an imminent threat on the United States of America that I, as commander-in-chief, will defend our nation, period, End of sentence. And I don't care. That is something that every president should have the ability to do as commander in chief. But was the Syrian Assad regime's awful, despicable violation of international law using chemical weapons a reason why the United States of America, a president acting on their own without approval for Congress, then should bomb the Assad regime? To me, there's no way you could look at a lens in with which that was a justifiable use of force without congressional approval. And you're seeing now is this erosion of congressional power. And by the way, Congress isn't doing their job because we just have sort of said, okay, yeah, take our power, because many people, I'm not making accusations, but you may not want to vote on a war vote. Those are tough votes to take. So in many ways, presidents have been getting away with doing engagements that I don't think are imminent threats to our country.
But that's been going on for decades. I guess I'm trying
to get
a sense of
sort of how it's been going on for years. I would say the 2001 authorization of military force, the post 9/11 authorizations, you go back and talk to some of those senators, if they imagine that we would be in a forever war, that when they were authorizing, they really imagine that we would be in Niger fighting the war on terrorism? Would we still be in the middle? No. And so there is a mature conversation going on in Congress saying we've got to rewrite an authorization of military force to try to take back some of our power.
So you would reserve the right to act unilaterally, but you would maybe figure out what you're going to do based on what your authorization is?
I was saying for more than a century in our country, that everybody knows that if a president needs to defend and make an imminent decision, that we are going to do that. I am a fighter. You come after Newark when I was mayor, you'd have a fight with me. If you come after the United States of America, dear God, I'm going to defend my nation. What I'm simply saying is, we are too quick to use military intervention under what I believe are not justifiable, not constitutionally supported means and mechanisms. And that's created a country where presidents think they can get into interventions without congressional approval, which is against the will of the people and against our Constitution.
So I have a different question, but let's just finish that point then. So it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're leveling some blame at Congress as well for not owning its responsibility as well.
Look, I think I'm happy to see there's been bipartisan voices, of which I've been, that say enough is enough. We've actually had some good hearings in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, of which I'm a member, that said, hey, let's look at the AUMF again, but we've yet to fully act. The first time I've seen some really good there's a political science term I'm sure you teach it to your kids called chutzpah. we've shown some chutzpah in Congress recently in trying to check the president's use of power in Yemen. He vetoed it, and then it came back to us, and we couldn't override his veto. Finally, you're seeing some Republicans stand up and try to check this president's use of military force. So you're starting to see some, I think, another political science term, moxie, to do the right thing, but it's not enough, and I'm tired of it. I'm running for president of the United States for a lot of reasons, but one of this is to affirm the separation of powers and make sure we're using military force in accordance with the Constitution and not doing it like we're doing it right now, which violates our values, violates the Constitution, creates extraordinary waste, and often compounds problems internationally that come back and haunt us.
I think it's an incredibly important point. We should hear a lot more candidates talking about it. I'm glad you are. But I think our founders, if they came back somehow today, would find our government unrecognizable. This was not what they intended. That balance was so critically important. Right, this imperial presidency. So let me shift gears a bit to veterans. I'm the son of a 100% disabled veteran. I have been a good portion of my life taking my dad to the VAs and navigating that system. And I have a lot of good stories to tell about the VA.
That's great.
I've also got some stories about the VA that aren't so good. The president made a lot of promises about what was going to change in the VA. I'm not so sure that's happening. The number of suicides each day by veterans who've returned from war is obnoxiously high. It's shockingly high. As president, what are you going to do to take care of those folks who we've made promises to that we failed to keep?
It is so shameful that we have come up with the money to send our men and women overseas to fight, and then when they come home, we plead poverty on doing what's right. And, you know, what I've found from people traveling around my state even, I mean, women having to wait weeks and months just for gynecological regular checkups, people having to travel hours and hours and hours just for care. I got so angry about it when I was a mayor that for the first time in New Jersey, we created a one-stop in a city hall. I'm not a federal, I wasn't a federal level of government, but I said, enough is enough. I'm going to create one point in Newark for my veterans to come to where they can get an array of services and don't have to navigate that Byzantine labyrinth of services and often fail to get what they need to help them in a time of crisis. From housing, I mean, we literally say we're the home of the brave, but when the brave come home, they don't find places to live. And so I hope that everybody in this race has to speak to what they already did. When I was mayor, I didn't wait for somebody else to solve this problem. We built disabled veterans housing. We did one stops. We changed our court system and created, the first time in New Jersey, veterans courts, because most Americans don't know this. Veterans are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system as well. And so as President of the United States, enough is enough. I will honor what we sing in our national anthem and truly make this a place that's a home for the brave, and a home is a nurturing place. So you come home, you get the services and the resources you need. And here's the thing. You know this. Veterans aren't charity cases. They've earned these benefits, earned these rights. And by the way, if you give them a little support, veterans are overrepresented when it comes to serving. Still serving when they come home, being there for other veterans, being there to counsel other veterans, being there to help veterans start businesses who have a higher success rates than the average American citizens, even in growing our economy. That's the kind of president I'm going to be. And these aren't false promises. Look what I've already done as an executive, and look, and you can see what I'm going to do when I become the chief executive of the United States of America.
Final thing, you'll like the premise of this one. The year is 2029. You've served two terms as president of the United States.
You are absolutely right.
What will you have left the American people? What do you hope to have accomplished in regards to, from the moral perspective of bringing our nation together, perhaps giving the press a little bit more of an equal spot at the table as the fourth estate? And what will you have accomplished in terms of policy?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying that, because the press is not the enemy of the people. That's something that totalitarian governments say. It's not something you say in a free democracy where you're your Bill of Rights starts with this affirmations of the freedom of the press.
So we'll look forward to a once-a-year Pints and Politics here at the Barlett House. New Hampshire is a swing state, so we'll look forward to having you back. Go ahead.
You are good. You are very good, sir. Yeah. But I think you put your nail on it, your finger on the big issue for me, is that I want one of my biggest legacies to be that I was a president that put more indivisible back into this one nation under God. And that I was able to have a revival of civic grace, and that to help inspire the deeper empathy that I know the reservoirs of empathy exist for each other in this country, to help us understand that we're all in this together. If we accomplish that, a lot of the things we think are hard right now become easy. Investments in infrastructure, public education, research and development. How do I know that? Because our parents and grandparents did that in a bipartisan way in the past. It was Eisenhower that did an infrastructure project that's would be worth over $1 trillion in today's money. It was in this nation that blew away humanity's abilities to innovate and come up with new ideas and innovation through our research and development dollars. We were once the best educators on the planet Earth for a child. We no longer do it, because now we're starving public education and undermining the success of our kids going to go to college, because we're saddling them with crippling debt. So I first and foremost want to do that, to end the meanness and the viciousness and the cruelty that exists in American zero-sum politics that pits us against each other. And then the second thing is, I want people to say what they say about my time when I was the last time I was a chief executive, when I asked a circle of reporters, I said, hey, if I told you back when I started that we would have done this, this, and this, and I was talking about our school system, crime and economic development, growing our population, I said to them, would you even believe me that it was possible? And then the reporters shook their head and said, no, we wouldn't have thought this would have been possible. Well, that's the kind of president I'm going to be, that when I finish and I'm leaving, and nobody can tell if I have gray hair or not because I'm bald, that people say, wow, look what we did, not what he did. Mm-hmm. Look what we did together. We again, on the planet Earth, of all of civilizations, we showed that we can bring this country and this people further and higher than we ever thought we can go. We were, as the great prophet from the Old Testament said, we were the light unto nations. And we did it by coming together, by bonding ourselves in that sense of common cause and common purpose. We were a nation who is now better, what we say we are, truly a nation of liberty and justice for all.
Senator Booker, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate you coming in. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Cory Booker here on Pints of Politics at the Barley House. 109-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College. We'll come back and wrap things up after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
This hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Check out riverbendcmhc.org for more information. Hampshire Primary interviews on the show presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
Welcome back. This is Pints and Politics here at the Barley House. 109-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show, Pints and Politics, presented by New England College. We just heard from U.S. Senator Cory Booker, Democratic presidential candidate really great edition of Pints of Politics here with him. Your takeaways, Dean?
Yeah, I think you got a nice sense of a combination of kind of his vision of leadership and how he would engage the presidency, combined with a nice kind of initial cut at domestic and foreign policy agenda. We got a little bit of a look into his decision-making process in terms of how he might move on foreign policy, which I thought was really interesting. He had a lot to say, and he seems to be really engaging people here. And it was a good first cut with him for us.
Yeah, we didn't get into it as much. A couple things we didn't get to as much as probably would have liked, but the use of executive power, both sure. in regards to domestic and foreign policy.
Yeah, we got at it a little bit on foreign policy,
right.
But we could have done more.
And so I thought that was interesting to hear him talk about how he would use the power of the military, and he was, as you mentioned, was a part of legislation with Senator Merkley and others that sought to reestablish right. what congressional authority was.
I wish Congress well with that. They've been trying to do that since the 70s with the war.
You're right. I mean, that's happened yes. pretty much each session that has been a key point.
But it's an important observation. I'm glad Dean went back with a follow-up on that, because the way he had left it originally, it really sounded a little fantastic in the sense of not possible.
Right.
But what he described then was a little bit more of a nuanced position,
right.
and so that was good. You know, to get somebody out there talking about the reauthorization of the use of military force, that's something I think that a lot of Americans would say, it's about time. It's been nearly 20 years since that was done, and we ought to be reexamining it. I thought that was good. I thought he was great. I loved seeing him do the retail politicking on Main Street out here yep. and here in the room. It was one of the better ones we've done.
Indeed. And what were your takeaways, particularly in regards to domestic policy stuff and how he would sit as president?
I think he's very knowledgeable. I think he talks quite a bit about with some depth and on issues. His experience as a mayor of Newark, I think, is very interesting to take a look at. It's a big city, but it's not a state. It's not a country. Mm-hmm. The competing interests there are important. I think the things that were most impressive to me is the way he talked about the sense of community. And I think that really harkened back to Barack Obama in ways that I think people will like, needing to get everybody around the table and to move away from all this divisiveness that is the focus of so much today.
And I think he does a good job of drawing connections between where he is now and kind of his own experience. He's still part of a community. It feels a lot fresher as a result. And I think that's helpful for him as well, to be able to talk about his experience as a mayor. It was good to hear him talk around the Medicare for All a little bit, because I think the phrase is starting to become almost meaningless, and he has a more nuanced view in mind, and I was glad to hear that.
One of the things that's really interesting about him is he doesn't speak like a politician per se, where generally when senators speak, they'll talk about, well, when I did this legislation, he did a little bit, we'll talk about Tim Kaine sure. and others, but we did this bit of legislation, and everything kind of comes back to that. Or talking in great detail about what took place. It's kind of what we did and how it affected people. Like, that seems to be his overall overarching theme, instead of going into depth and great detail and trying to impress the two college professors and the dude in the vest. He is speaking to people about solutions to problems. And to me, that's always been one of the most effective things about him, where you can tell that he has that intellectual capability, but he is able to speak in a way that says, okay, I've solved problems and this is how I've done it.
Yeah, he's a guy that, he emphasized very modest roots. He comes, the neighborhood that he continues to live in that he talked about. That stuff plays well in North Country. That plays well in old mill towns, where folks feel like they've been left out of the conversation. And he's asserting that, no, you can still be part of it. It's a very much an everyman sort of campaign, at least the way he describes it. There's a certain amount of charisma that he applies to it as well. It's compelling and it's authentic to him, and that goes a long way.
Gentlemen, as always, appreciate your time and really good Pints of Politics today.
Very good. Thanks, Chris.
Wayne Westbrant, Dean Sebeldis, this has been Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 139, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints of Politics presented by New England College.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also by New Futures.
Hi, I'm Sydney. I am going into my senior year at the University of New Hampshire, and I am a medical microbiology major. I chose to go in-state because it's affordable and New Hampshire's beautiful. It has a lot of great experiences. And also UNH offered a lot of majors that I felt were more applicable to what I was interested in. I feel like my job opportunities in New Hampshire are great. UNH has a career fair every spring and fall, and that gave me the opportunity to find a great internship in New Hampshire. And because of that, hopefully I will be able to get a job later on. It's given me great experiences that I would not have gotten elsewhere. There's so many great things to do when you stay in New Hampshire. There's skiing, there's tons of research opportunities, there's a great nightlife. Learn more about education opportunities in New Hampshire via the New Hampshire College and University Council by going to visitnewhampshirecolleges.com.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, but to end the stigma associated with mental illness, mental health awareness needs to not just be about May, but every day. You can be a part in ending that stigma by telling your story. At times, that's not easy. Be courageous, be honest, and in doing so, you can help to end the stigma associated with mental illness. Mental health awareness is not just about May, but every day. This message paid for by Riverbend Community Mental Health and RiverbendCMHC.org. Treatment works.